I'm Tristan Hallman, and this is the inaugural episode of the Texas Crime Cast. My co-hosts today are Tasha Chaparis.
Hi.
And Sarah Mervosh.
Hey there.
And this is Ahmed Muhammad, a 14-year-old Irving student who was suspended after he brought a clock to school.
And the clock was made in a metal case, a metal box, and I put the circuit board in there with the digital display in there with it. And I put it in place, and I showed my teacher, and it got to the point where I was arrested.
Today we'll be talking about that story, which blew up on social media. Even the president weighed in. Our special guest will be Avi Selk, the Irving reporter who broke that story. As I mentioned, this is our first episode. We are the Dallas Morning News, so our focus will be in North Texas. But we'll also delve into major Texas stories. And we hope to talk to the newsmakers and the people who bring you the news to give you some fresh insight on the biggest stories of the week, like Avi. So with that, let's get into it. Tasha, you and I did a story that ran this week on panhandling in Dallas, and it's become a big issue downtown. There's a social media campaign around it, the hashtag Enforce, which has taken off. 7-Eleven responded by adding security. 10 of its downtown convenience stores between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m., so the overnight hours when people say they frequently run into these panhandlers. The problem is many people have associated panhandlers with the homeless population, and those aren't necessarily connected. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. A lot of people have really taken to social media posting pictures of people they suspect to be panhandlers. Sometimes they may just be homeless people walking down the street. They have claimed that there is a vast increase in the number of people panhandling downtown, and they also suggest that they have become more aggressive. Police have said that there have been incidents of some really aggressive panhandlers really kind of accosting people for money, chasing after them, saying if they don't give money, and they feel scared and threatened by this, and they want to feel safe in their homes. And that's happening, and that is true. But to the extent that it's increasing, that doesn't necessarily seem to be true. The number of homeless people living on the streets downtown is decreasing. The homeless population across North Texas is also decreasing. And police say that panhandlers and homelessness, you know, doesn't necessarily line up. Not everyone who panhandles is homeless. Many of them are just scam artists.
I think one of the things that we covered in there is maybe there are even fewer. We don't know how many there are. There's no such thing as a panhandler census, although, you know, some groups are trying to count the amount of times that they've seen a panhandler downtown. But there's really nothing to compare it to. Do you think that, and one of the things that we covered is, do you think that it's just because there are more people living downtown than there had been in the past?
Sure, absolutely. There are more people living downtown. With social media, it definitely seems to be very prevalent, people posting photos. So it seems like it's happening a lot. You know, you kind of are seeing a revival for the fifth, sixth time in Deep Ellum, where more people are starting to spend time there. There's a lot of businesses there, and there are people walking along the street. And the fact of the matter is, sometimes someone may appear to be homeless, and so they may seem like a threat, but they might not necessarily be asking people for money.
I thought there was a really interesting anecdote in your story about there was a man who was walking up to people just asking for water. He wasn't asking for money, and so not everyone is really begging or asking for money and may not even be homeless, like you said.
Right, yeah. And we hung around, Tristan and I went into Deep Ellum and hung around a 7-Eleven, and we definitely did encounter a more aggressive man who seemed possibly intoxicated or on something. For the most part, he just asked people for their drinks, and he did ask a few people for money. But the other man did just ask for water, and when I approached him, I didn't immediately say that I was a reporter. I just said, "What are you doing over here?" And he's like, I just want some water. I'm not trying to bother anyone." So I think there a lot of people are getting the sense, homeless people are getting the sense that people are scared of them and think that they're a nuisance.
Right. That possibly intoxicated man, we were sitting there and a police car rolled up, probably just to go inside 7-Eleven and get something. And as soon as they rolled up, he stopped talking to us and got the heck out of there.
Yeah, he left pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So is there something that people should be doing if they feel passionately about this issue either way? I mean, you mentioned the hashtag. Are there avenues to work this out?
Well, there are a lot of groups who have been petitioning. The biggest, I guess, achievement of that group right now is actually getting 7-Eleven to respond and adding additional security. You know, as always, talk to your local city council member and they can kind of help you out a little bit.
All right. Sarah, you also covered a story this week that I've got a lot of attention as well.
Yeah, this was a story about a Dallas man who got no prison time for killing his transgender girlfriend. His name was Jonathan Kenney, and he was originally charged with the murder when his girlfriend, Jeanette Tovar, died of blunt force injuries. He slammed her head against concrete, and she later died. And he went to court this week and ended up taking a plea deal. And basically, he pleaded guilty to aggravated assault instead of murder, and therefore he got 10 years probation. And so the fact that he got probation really upset Jeanette's family. They're publicizing the slogan, Justice for Jeanette, and trying to gain traction within the Trans Lives Matter movement. So even though her death wasn't classified as a hate crime, it was classified as domestic violence. The story has sort of generated a lot of talk about how society values a transgender life and about issues of domestic violence within the LGBT community.
He got probation. Is there any chance that he's going to serve prison time at all for this?
So he could. If he violates his probation any time within the next 10 years, the judge has the full range of punishment, which is 5 years to 99 or life in prison. So there's a chance that he could serve prison time if he violates the probation.
Probation even seems kind of low for an aggravated assault. How did that play out that he got that sentence?
Yeah, the attorneys didn't want to talk, so there wasn't a lot of details about how that happened. Aggravated assault is still first-degree felonies, just like murder. It's just a different circumstances, a different charge. But there was reportedly talk that there was concerns that Jeanette, the girlfriend, had some mutual combat and aggression in the fight as well. And so it was sort of hard to prove. And that's a common thing in domestic violence. And it's actually, not totally unheard of for someone to get probation for causing someone's death. There was actually a high-profile case earlier this year where a high school basketball player was charged with manslaughter for killing a fellow high school basketball player, and he also got probation.
We see this every now and then, but to the common person, it looks like he killed her. How did that go to aggravated assault then, instead of murder or another charge?
Yeah, I think it was something about the fact that he slammed her her head on the ground, concrete, and then I believe she was fine for some time. And then later in the day, she was unresponsive. And so they could prove there was the aggravated assault, but because they couldn't necessarily prove that it was murder. That's my understanding.
And what was the reaction like? I mean, how did people react in the courtroom when it happened?
Yeah, it was a really tense atmosphere in the courtroom. Her family came in wearing T-shirts with her photo and RIP on them, which is actually fairly common at the courthouse. But they had signs that said Justice for Jeanette, hashtag Trans Lives Matter, the world is watching. They actually brought her ashes in a black box, which was actually a contentious moment with the judge because they had the ashes displayed in the spectator area of the courtroom, and the judge asked them to take it down. And there was some tension in the courtroom, and his Jonathan Kenney's family, I believe his family, his loved ones were there. And so it's always just pretty emotional and pretty intense when you've got the victim's family and the suspect in the same room for the first time often in many years. And I should mention that the family is actually the Dallas has its pride parade this weekend. The family is going to have a march and possibly a float in the parade this weekend to raise awareness about her cause.
How has the LGBT community at large in Dallas reacted?
You know, I don't know too much about that. I did see some things on social media where, again, it's just like talking about the value of a transgender life and would this be the case if it were, just a heterosexual person. And I don't think we've even gotten into that. There's no indication that that was a factor. But to the community, it's important to make sure we're treating everyone equally and valuing a life because a life was lost.
Right.
Well, one more thing before we get to Avi and Irving, obviously the hot topic, a murder that actually hasn't been solved yet. So police still haven't caught the murderer, whoever shot Kendra Hatcher. They do have the alleged getaway driver, Crystal Cortez, in custody, charged with capital murder.
This is the Uptown Dentist case that's drawing so much attention.
Right. This is the woman who was in her parking garage and was ambushed. A lot of the attention is focused on her ex, but everything we've heard, it's gone quiet. We've heard that the ex was jealous. We've heard...
her boyfriend's ex-girlfriend.
Right.
It's a very confusing case.
There's a tangled web here. The boyfriend of Kendra Hatcher, the dentist, her ex-girlfriend has been sort of identified as someone of interest to police. Not publicly, but through search warrant documents. They've searched her apartment. They said that she lent the Jeep to the getaway driver who was supposed to rob Kendra Hatcher. She hasn't been arrested. We still haven't heard why. But I guess stay tuned on that.
How is the family, Kendra Hatcher's family, reacting to having an idea of who might be involved and not seeing someone actually be arrested on a murder charge?
They put out some public statements through a spokesperson. But basically what they've said at this point, they're in Illinois, so it's hard for us to reach them. But what they've said is that they cannot feel like justice has been served until there has been an arrest made of the actual shooter. The getaway driver claims she had nothing to do with the shooting. She didn't know it was going to turn into a murder. So there's still a lot of questions out there.
Now, we've heard a lot about the getaway driver, and we've heard about the ex-girlfriend of her Hatcher's boyfriend. Now, but what about the shooter? I mean, that seems like...
We've heard absolutely nothing about the shooter. In every police document, it's pretty much said unidentified male. So we have no idea who it is. We don't know if police know who it is. They won't say anything about the case.
Did the getaway driver even have an idea of who it is?
Getaway driver said she didn't know who it was.
Wow.
Yeah, I guess stay tuned. This one is just, I know a lot of my friends in Uptown and in Dallas are always really talking about it. Sort of shook the community because it happened in such a high-profile location, and I'm curious to see what's going to happen.
Absolutely.
Joining us now is Avi Selk, who, as we mentioned, broke the story about Ahmed Mohammed, the 14-year-old Irving student who was arrested after he brought a homemade clock to school and became a national sensation. Hi, Avi.
Hi, happy to be here.
Can you talk a little bit about how you first heard about this story and if you had any idea that it would take off the way that it did?
Now, I first got the story in a morning text from a man named Anthony Bond, who's sort of a local activist in Irving. He, he tries to kind of help out basically, students in trouble or people he thinks are kind of getting a bad shake. And he shops a lot of stories to me and other local media. Most of those stories I don't pick up on. And this one, I knew it was a story, and I emailed my editor right away saying, worth pursuing this. But right up until, honestly, like after I'd filed it, I thought it was just a little daily story. It almost didn't come together at all. I had no idea it was going to go on the front page, and I had no idea it was going to, break our hit counts and go all over the world like that.
So what do you see next for the family after this? I mean, there's no normal life after this. So what's going to happen to them?
I have no idea what's going to happen to them. At the moment, I don't know exactly where they are. I was trying to reach them this morning, and it sounded like maybe they're at an airport or something. Now all their phones are off, and I don't know. They're probably on their way to some sort of booking with somebody in New York City, I would imagine. The sister, his sister, Aisha, Ahmed's big sister, said exactly that his life is never going to be normal again. I'm kind of interested to see if this is sort of a flash in terms of the social media explosion, where there's just a flash in the pan and, nobody really wants to read about him in a week. But even if that happens, this is going to have a lasting effect on the family, absolutely, and probably at least the city that he lives in. It's really shaken up, the local political structure there. And I can say one thing for sure. This kid is not going to have any trouble finding good schools to go to. I think he's got more scholarship offers than he can possibly take.
Can you tell us a little bit about Irving's history with the Muslim population? That's been a contentious issue here in Dallas.
Yeah. I've written a lot of stories in the last few months. The Muslim issue in Irving didn't really exist last year. It kind of did at a low level among sort of the Tea Party groups who do have a lot of influence in local politics. But it became this huge city council issue back in the spring when this crazy rumor starts going around that the Muslims have set up their very first Muslim Sharia court in Irving, and American law is falling away, and it's a horrible precedent. And it's absolute nonsense. It was, you know, loosely based on some low-key Islamic mediation group that was, you know, voluntarily resolving settlements for Muslims who wanted to pay them to do so. But instead of letting that just kind of fade out, the mayor of Irving, Beth Van Dyne, went on Glenn Beck and, you know, this show and that show, kind of talking it up and positioning herself as sort of a champion fighting against this supposed Sharia court, culminates in this just absolutely, you know, just spectacle of a city council vote where the council is voting on some sort of meaningless resolution to oppose a non-existent court. And, you know, it's just people in headscarves outraged and people waving American flags, you know, spouting, you know, just absolutely horribly bigoted things. And that has continued on through the summer as the mayor has sort of gone on a speaking circuit to Tea Party groups and conservative groups as far away as New York, sort of taking credit for protecting in whatever particular speech he's given, it's either women's rights or American freedom. And so all of that, now, you know, interestingly, Ahmed's family knew none of this. They were just completely clued out to local politics. But it did exactly kind of line up from a news perspective. And already, like, you know, national media is sort of linking the two things together. It's turning into a narrative.
Avi, could you, you mentioned Beth Van Dyne. Could you tell us a little bit about the way that she has reacted to this incident?
The way she's reacted to the incident that I've seen is all through her Facebook account, which is how she generally communicates with the media. She's been doing that for months. I mean, she doesn't talk on the phone to me anymore. But she put out a statement yesterday, and she was one of the few, you know, high-ranking people connected to this story to support the police. Said that they followed proper procedures. She had a graph in that statement saying that, you know, terrible violent things happen in schools all the time, and maybe if people were more vigilant, they wouldn't. That did not play well in the media. She, you know, her Facebook account, which had hitherto been nothing but supporters of the mayor, you know, saying how great she was, just filled up with just really quite awful comments, calling her every name in the book. And she deleted a significant portion of that statement and replaced it with something about being a parent and concerned, you know, trying to put herself in Ahmed's parents' shoes. I did ask her why she changed the statement and didn't get a satisfactory response.
How do you see this playing out in the long run? This incident, obviously part of now being linked to a larger narrative about the Muslim community's relationship in Irving. How do you see it playing out long term with the Muslim community that's there?
I think it's obviously brought something that has been very concerning to a lot of Muslims in Irving, but wasn't really, you know, our paper kind of made a big deal out of it, but it didn't really travel very far outside of, you know, the region that we print in. Now it's, you know, the entire world is, when they think of Irving, they think of Islamophobia, whether fairly or not. And if I were a Muslim living in Irving who's kind of concerned about the local politics in the last few months, I might be kind of happy that that's happened, because essentially, you know, your local government is now being held accountable to an international audience, which as a reporter, I have to say, is always a good thing.
So getting back to sort of the international audience and the viral aspect of this story, you said you didn't even know the story was going to go on the front page. You weren't quite sure how viral it was going to go. What was your first indication that the story had gone viral? I hear there were some direct messages with Montel Williams, per se.
Yeah, that's probably when I was, so a few hours after we put it online, and I'm kind of, sitting around planning to go to bed early, and then my phone beeps. Oh, somebody retweeted this story. Oh, somebody else retweeted. And a few times I nearly emailed my editor saying, this might be big, and then deleted the email thinking, no, it's not going to go anywhere. And then, Montel Williams starts DMing me on Twitter saying, what is it? What's going on in this city? It's just, like, I was just in Irving. Like, it's crazy. So, I sent him a few links to some of the stuff that I just talked about regarding the Islamophobia claims. And he started getting interested and saying that this could be big. And then, I get a text from Anthony Bond, the guy who kind of shot me the story, saying, like, what? I just saw a hashtag, I stand with Ahmed. And apparently the school district is begging him to, like, come meet with them. And I'm like, oh, okay. I ended up staying up till like 2 a.m. just completely addicted to Twitter, just, as one more major news org after another picked up the story. And, before I went to bed, my editor had emailed me saying, we're going to need you to do a follow tomorrow. And I was, well, no kidding.
How did it feel to be tweeted about by Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama?
I don't think they tweeted about me. They tweeted about Ahmed. So I know that he was excited.
Avi, do you think that, I guess, which aspect of this story has most captured people's attention? Is it the fact that this was a Muslim boy who was arrested, or the fact that he was arrested for taking some little piece of technology to school that he'd tinkered with?
I think maybe that's part of, if I could postmortem this thing one day and say what components made it such an explosive story, I think it's actually both of those. I saw this on National Review, the flagship conservative magazine. And, they had at least one writer saying, hashtag I stand with Ahmed, not because of this Islamophobia nonsense. I don't think it has anything with Islamophobia, but because it's an example of local, out of control local government being authoritarian, which is, a huge issue to conservatives. And Islamophobia, really just sort of any of this sort of xenophobic or kind of bigoted undercurrent that's kind of running through social media and running through a lot of American politics is very concerning to a lot of liberals. So it's something that it's definitely more the liberal side that's outraged by this, but the conservatives aren't, from what I've seen, going to step up and defend the police because they see this as, at best, an example of kind of foolish government overstep.
Avi, one more thing. How is the family handling the newfound fame that comes from going viral?
Well, Ahmed's teenage sisters, Aisha and Ima, and I hope I'm remembering to pronounce their names correctly, kind of overnight became his ad hoc, like, media handlers. Like I said, he didn't even care about Twitter. He hadn't even checked it after he got kicked out of school and arrested to see if his classmates were talking about it. So they were, we need to, like, get this kid a Twitter account and a Gmail account. So they take the I Stand With Ahmed hashtag and turn it into a, at I Stand With Ahmed. And they were, to some extent, they were tweeting from that I Stand With Ahmed account after kind of like saying, what do you want to say? What do you want to? They were like his de facto kind of almost media handlers slash big sisters slash, stunned fans, because at the same time they were just a mile a minute talking about, oh my God, you see it's the number two trending and now it's the number one trending, and they're running out to the car. Hillary Clinton just tweeted it. It's really just an amazing kind of scene. Now, I'd assume that if this kid doesn't already have a professional media handler, he's going to very soon. So the sisters seemed to do a good enough job yesterday, though.
Well, we'll work on getting you a professional media handler as well. I know you're busy, but thanks for joining us today.
Sure, happy to do it.
We appreciate it. Avi Selk. And that's a wrap for this week. In the next few days, look for news about Dallas County District Attorney Susan Hawk. She has been on leave for 7 weeks as she battles depression and was scheduled to come back to work next week. We'll see if that happens. Now there are concerns about that. Go to dallasnews.com for more details on Irving and Dallas crime news. And be sure to join us for the podcast again next week and every week. Thanks to Tommy Noel, our producer this week, and Naomi Martin and Kevin Krause, who helped behind the scenes. Once again, for Tasha Chaparis and Sarah Mervosh, I'm Tristan Hallman. Stay safe out there.